Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.
David Gray is back on Lee Side. You're very welcome, not for the first time.
Nice to be back.
Your history with Cork goes back many, many years, doesn't it? I know of the Live at the Marquee gigs, but we can go further back, can't
Let's
we, to
back.
Smaller venues. What do you recall?
Much smaller. Well, the very first trip to Ireland was two gigs. It was the Whelans show. It's this February 1994, and then down to the Triskell Arts Centre here in Cork, so which was a much more listening gig. The Whelans gig was a lively show, and the other one was quite a different affair where everyone was really listening intently.
Yeah,
yeah, so that's where it goes back, right, virtually to the beginning, I suppose.
But I saw the Lobby, Henry's, the Savoy,
Henry's,
the Opera House,
yeah.
Musgrave Park. Henry's would have been interesting.
Nancy Spain's as well, don't forget.
You don't forget, well done.
I'll never forget the sort of strange grotto with wooden carved fungus on the front of the stage. It had a sort of magic mushroomy quality
to
it. Yeah, and the dressing room was the kitchen. Yeah, no, I've had a few Guinness in there and waited to go on. So, yeah, amazing. It goes way back, and those gigs were feisty affairs. You know, there was a passion there. The kind of wild Cork way. There's a kind of unkempt quality to sort of like places like Nancy's and Sir Henry's, a kind of mad thing. But and yet somehow the magic happens. So that's all
magic
part nights
at the Lobby Bar, they used to say. But I mean, that were in the very early days, right?
Yeah.
A relative unknown, if you like.
Yeah.
You had three albums before White Ladder, yeah?
Yeah.
And then White Ladder came along.
It did.
And that's been a major game changer for you, right?
Hashtag game changer.
Hashtag 12 million copies of all of your albums when you cum them. That's insane, isn't it?
Yeah, it did change everything. It was a crazy story. And obviously a record we made for nothing and then put out ourselves. It was the most unlikely success story.
Yeah, but if I remember correctly, I know we spoke about this in the past, but you know, you had been dropped by the label, and I don't mean to say that in any kind of a negative kind of way, but that was the reality of it.
So it is negative, though.
Yeah, yeah.
we're not renewing. There's a hard to put a spin on. We're not renewing your contract,
and that's it. So you would have been, I guess.
We think you'd develop better, you know, on your own.
what idiots they were! Look at what they missed just around the corner.
Maybe, but I mean, this was the early '90s. It was hard to kind of find a way. America obviously always has its sort of acoustic music traditions, so it's slightly different story over there, but they've got their own artists, so they don't need a load of sort of young bucks from the UK coming over to tell them what to do. But in the UK it was dance music and Britpop, and it was hard to find the space, really. But obviously by the time you get to the late 90s, it was ready to change, and that's when the White Ladder moment happened. So it was the right thing at the right place at the right time.
But you were broke. You thought your musical career had ended. You recorded it between a bedroom and a bathroom, I believe. Is that right?
No, it's true. Yeah, we did use the bathroom too. It was mainly in the spare bedroom. So yeah, it was a backs against the wall moment, but it's not like it had a kind of gloom over it. I think I was just determined to try and make a record that was the best thing we could possibly do, and one that said more than just traced my influences. You could hear something of the present day in the music. So I was friends with Orbital and I was going to their gigs. So that sort of world of dance music and the sounds that they managed to involve in what they were doing. I was thirsty to get something else into my music that sort of spoke more about my experiences in the early or mid 90s. So that's what White Ladder ended up being, a sort of hybrid form. And more than that, it was strengthened by, I mean, previously I would just write songs and the band would come in on them when we were in a studio situation. But with that, I was writing on the hoof in the studio, and Clun and Yestin, when he got involved to produce, would be involved in sculpting the sound. So they were a sort of part of that process, and it enabled something different to happen. That was part of what went on. It was a unique moment when I had to sort of admit other people onto the sort of ground floor of my creative process. But what happened was it didn't dilute it, it strengthened it, actually.
Was it an easy album to write, or you know, because of where you were at that point in your musical career, or did it just appear? Was it was it a gift to the likes of Babylon, This Year's Love?
Some songs happened very quickly.
Like, do you write the song musically first or lyrically first?
No, I usually write the music and then the lyric comes on after. Yeah, I mean, songs like Babylon didn't sort of happen in one go. I was trying to work it out. It took a little while to figure it out. Songs like Please Forgive Me and This Year's Love, I wrote them incredibly quickly.
Oh, quickly.
So what, like an hour maybe for
Bizarre.
For, please forgive me. And maybe This Year's Love, like a few hours. So, well, I mean, just got into it and it all kind of just fell together. And then suddenly there it was. So Please Forgive Me was definitely a moment of inspiration in inverted commas. But most of it, like Sail Away, wasn't like that. That was, again, a slow process. It took me a while to work out the chorus, same as Babylon. The chord changes, how is it going to evolve? I had the verses worked out, but how was I going to evolve the song and the lyric? So other things happened in the studio, like songs like We're Not Right, and there was a playfulness. But once we got the soundscape of Babylon, it was like a key moment. Hearing the vocoders and the kind of drum machines and the way that Yestin was treating the sound, this kind of interesting, kind of gnarly, kind of home recording, kind of dance music type kind of vibe, but with my acoustic guitar and live vocal over the top, I just thought, oh, this is something different. I remember the Babylon moment very, very clearly when we were recording it, because once we put the vocoders on, they were like so simple, but it just sounded so good, just with the basic elements.
So do you know then, with those three tracks on it and more besides, that you're on a winner? Do you get that sense then?
No, we didn't. We were just trying to do the best thing we could and make a record that flowed from start to finish. So we didn't want to stop the creative process until we had something that started at the very beginning of the record, flowed from one track to another all the way, nine tracks into the 10th, and completed itself when you felt like you'd gone on a journey. So that's what we were trying to achieve, and something that tied together as well thematically, sonically, and in every way. But we didn't know we had anything of value in terms of...
Did somebody else not say it to you?
Commercial. It would have been a preposterous extension from the sort of miserable failure rate we had at that point as a sort of commercial artist to think that something was going to happen. We hoped we'd connect with the music. That was the best we could hope for. And I remember when we mastered the record, I was proud of what we'd done. I thought, I don't know what it is. I don't know what we've made, but all I know is we couldn't have done more. And even right now, down to the mastering process, making little tweaks and changes, like adding that extra bit of bottom end, for example, on the kick that comes in and on the Please Forgive Me mastering, that I remember when we put a little bit more floor in. So when it comes back in at the end, it's like, boom, I was like, yeah,
you
baby.
You describe it so well.
Remember thinking, I don't know what it is, but we've got something. Let's see what happens.
So when you say, let's see what happens, is it a bit like sending your child off to school for the first day?
Of course. Are they going to get bullied? Are they going to pee themselves during the first lesson?
Are they going to be ignored? Are they not going to make any friends?
Are they going to become captain of the soccer team? You just don't know how it's going to play out.
The same for an album.
Of course, yeah. You can't defend it once it leaves the safe shores of your little studio. That's why some people take so long to put things out, because it's bloody terrifying once you send it out there.
Wow, because you know, I do know what happened in Ireland. We started to pick it up on airplay on radio, started to play it and play it more, and people liked all of the songs. This was very much an Irish thing. Irish people took you to heart so much. I suppose it's fair to say that White Ladder now is an essential of every household as much as, say, a kettle is. Do you know what I mean? It's a must-have item.
Not quite as useful, though.
But got better, of course, when the vinyl version came out years later. That was a godsend, because vinyl is king, right?
Yeah, I mean, good old vinyl. I was sad to see it go.
But it's back with a boom, baby.
Well, not with a boom. It's back with a sort of partial boom. Okay. It's not the sonic boom that it once was.
But what about the Irish aspect to it? Chris Rea often spoke about that as well as your good self, that the Irish took him to heart. You would say the same, wouldn't you? It started in Ireland. You weren't having a whole lot of success initially in the UK. That followed, right?
Yeah, it did, yeah. And it was the momentum we gained. And not just the momentum, the commercial. I mean, the UK is very arrogant and cynical. Even when we were selling tens of thousands of records over here, the execs over in the UK were like, yeah, so what? It's Ireland. What do they know? Kind of thing.
Wow.
You know, that's just the truth of it. We got to the end of 99 and we were playing the biggest show we could, which was the Point Depot. And that was a sort of statement show. And we tried to get people across to that show to get them interested. And by that point, they were starting to pay a bit more attention. But I think that what happened was the self-belief we had, we'd seen it grow from absolutely nothing. And not to the first moment that those songs dropped live, we could see the power they had over the audience. We knew we were onto something. Just like, let us get one toenail in the door in the UK and we'll prove you wrong.
Yeah. Kind of thing.
And so it eventually, someone was willing to take like a punt on it. And they did. And they came in with all guns blazing, in fairness. And Christian Tattersfield at East West. They really could not, though. And then it became a massive success over there. And of course, the rest is history.
The rest is history, 12 million albums in total. 12 million sales.
No one's counted for a while. I think it's more than that.
Is it really?
Let's just say 15.
Okay.
Let's just leave it there.
Okay. Which means you'll never have a lean day, thanks be to God, if nothing else. But certainly 14 albums later. It's a long way from a century ends.
It is, yeah. It's been a journey, as they say these days. It was character building, the first phase. And then White Ladder transformed everything. And then I had to learn to negotiate success.
What do you mean by that?
Well, because it brings its own problems. I mean, ubiquity and the sort of straitjacket of being known for just a few songs, and then that's you sort of over. You've been sort of, that's you. That's, you've had your moment, and then what are you supposed to do after it? So I think if your creative soul is still stirring and you want to continue to commit to the new, then what are you supposed to do with the sort of prison that success can become, when you're just supposed to turn into a jukebox to sort of gratify the audience? Or how do you find, and I've not been willing to accept that, so I've tried to plow a furrow that buys me the time to not just play the songs that everyone loves at the right moment, but also to keep pushing new music and sculpting new space for my sounds and my ideas with my audience. And if you give them what they want all the time, what they think they want, then you don't leave no space for anything else. So it's a constant negotiation from the moment of grand success onwards. You're trying to figure out, but it's not just that. I think ubiquity brings all kinds of problems. You just sort of, yeah, it sums you up in a couple of sentences, and the rest of the detail gets lost.
But does it come easy to you to write?
In one sense, yes, but I think the challenge is to make something worthwhile and to really test it before you. I mean, it's easy to just vomit up whatever it is, your emotions or whatever, in some kind of musical form. But why should anyone be compelled to listen to it? And, you know, why should it command the world's interests? Don't take that for granted just because they listened to you last time. So it's got to be vetted by a kind of a scrupulous process. So it's easy to come up with ideas, but are they any good? And I mean, I don't know now. I work blind, but I've been in the process of making for so long that I'm sort of conditioned into it now. I've got ideas coming through all the time. I mean, I'm constantly, at the back of my mind even now, is sort of picking over things that I'm trying to work out. Even when I'm sort of asleep, I'm working on these things. So it's not that it's difficult to come up with ideas, but it's hard to have the White Ladder moment.
Yeah, none of those came to you. The bigger ones came to you in your sleep, like McCartney's.
No, I haven't had a sleep song, but I've had songs that just dropped out the sky, like Please Forgive Me, from absolutely nowhere. And suddenly I had, you know, an hour later, I just had this thing, and it's like, wow, where did that come from?
It's amazing, actually. Are you self-taught then?
Well, yeah, no one's taught me how to write.
No, but I mean, is that, that's the original beast, is it?
No, this is not my first guitar, but this I bought this in Manchester A1 Music in like March 1994.
So you wrote White Ladder on that?
This is the White Ladder guitar.
It's a bit like Rory Gallagher's one. Is that all sweat marks and bashing?
No sweat marks as such, but it's got lots of dents. And, you know, I don't sort of... I don't try and smash it up, but I had a sort of particularly rough style when I started, so I used to break a lot of strings, and obviously the very soft wood, I've just kind of gone through it, so it's got holes in it that have been repaired.
But isn't it funny, you wouldn't trade up, though? It's just your baby, is it?
No, it's just the guitar I brought with me this time, but it feels, it's become my favourite. There's something's happened. I brought it back out of semi-retirement. I used to use it in the studio, but I brought it back for the White Ladder anniversary tour because it was the record I recorded the songs on. And since then, I've not want to let go of it. So, it's,
could you imagine what that would
my number
make at
one
auction,
now.
Then?
Well, this has already come up, Ridley, on this short trip.
Is it really?
I have no idea, but I mean, let's just start bids at £1 million.
Any offers? So you're going to play for us?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. guess the song. Friday night, I'm going nowhere. All the lights are changing green to red. Turning over TV stations, situations running through my head. Looking back through time, you know it's clear that I've been blind, I've been a fool. To open up my heart to all the jealousy and bitterness that ridicule. Saturday, I'm running wild, and all the lights are changing red to green. Moving through the crowd, I'm pushing, chemicals are rushing in my bloodstream. I only wish that you were here, you know I'm seeing it so clear. I've been afraid to show you how I really feel. Admit to some of those bad mistakes I've made. Come on. And if you want it, come and get it, crying out loud. The love that I was giving you was never in doubt. But go ahead, go ahead and feel it now. But go ahead, and go ahead and feel it now. Babylon, Babylon. Sunday, all the lights of London, shining sky is fading, red to blue. Well, I'm kicking through the autumn leaves and wondering where it is you might be going to. And then I'm turning back for home, you know I'm feeling so alone, I can't believe. Climbing on the stair, I turn around to see you smiling there in front of me. Whoa, now, if you want it, come and get it, crying out loud. The love that I was giving you was never in doubt. Then go ahead, go ahead.
Thing, man. A magic moment. David Gray, thank you so much for popping in.
My pleasure.
And good luck with the Live at the Marquee gigs, 13th, 14th of June.
13th and 14th. One of those is my birthday, 13th.
Well, so happy birthday for them.
Come on down. Join the birthday fun.
Good to see you, man.
Cheers.